Interlude. Christophsis. On the first day, five pilgrims depart from their starship and set out across one of the countless deep cave systems of Christophsis. They set out with great purpose, bringing with them a sacred gift that was stolen from this place not that long ago. Kyber crystals. Gems that grow at only a few precious spots here on this world. Though much of this world is crystalline, the Kyber crystals are considerably more rare. The Kyber crystals were taken from this world by the Empire and used to construct the world-killing laser of the Death Star, though they were also used by the once peacekeepers of this galaxy, the Jedi, in constructing their lightsabers. Bryn Iziska said that these must be returned from whence they came, Christophsis, to their, in his words, home. One of the pilgrims is a droid, an MABO cargo lifter droid they call Mabo, and he is the one who carries the crate that holds what was stolen. On the third day, as they march up a steep, rocky embankment studded with crystal spires and slippery scree, Adar, the human, confides in his friend Juman, the Ayakeru. "I don't know why we are doing this." Juman shrugs it off and growls.
"Because this is what must be done."
His whiskers twitch when he says it, as if this explains it all. And yet Adar, who is young, untested, and uncertain, persists.
"I just mean, what's the point?"
"Tonight, around the fire, we will watch the Holovids again to help you understand."
And they do. When night falls, they start a fire underneath one of the vents leading out to the open sky, where Adar looks up and sees a spray of stars that gleam and glitter like the walls of these caves. Juman has Madramagath, the Elomin, set out the projector disc. From it emits the crackling, staticky holoform of Bryn Iziska, the pastor and philanthropist who governs their faith and their community, the Church of the Force. The image of Iziska goes on about the heritage of the Force, about how all things are connected, and about how the Jedi do not control the Force, but rather are merely conduits for it.
"Antennae, attuned to that cosmic frequency,"
the man says. And even in the holoform, it's easy to see the wonder dancing in his eyes like torchlight. But Adar isn't feeling it. Adar isn't feeling any of it. When the vid is done, Juman must sense his apprehension and barks,
"We do it because we do it. Because these must return home."
Juman rolls over in his pack and goes to sleep. And that's the end of that. On the fourth day, they enter the crystal forest. Here, the trees are weak and wispy, their bulk more like threads than trunks, their branches like filaments. And yet they stand tall, because they are encased in blue crystal. Some even grow up from the ground and marry with the ceiling. When the cave wind moves through them, it keens and moans, a shrill cacophony coupled with dread, groaning lamentations. As the fourth day ends and the fifth day begins, Madramagath consults with Ugorda the Duros. His cheeks lose their rosy bloom, and his horns twitch as he says,
"We are being hunted."
Ugorda confirms it, and she says,
"Stay vigilant."
Given how rarely she speaks, the warning carries extra meaning, and fear scurries through every micrometer of Adar.
"We shouldn't have come,"
he thinks. On the sixth day, Madramagath is found dead. He goes off into the crystal trees to relieve himself, and he never returns. They discover his body, cut to pieces as if by saw blade. Juman snarls.
"Now we know what hunts us."
"What?"
Adar asks.
"Kayadak."
They do not stop to camp that night. They hurry on. On the morning of the seventh day, they hear the kayadak. The tack, tack, tack of their many limbs. The click, click, click of their calicery. By midday, they begin to see their sign. Scratches in the crystalline trees. Gleaming silicates scat, smeared across bulging rock. By evening, they see them. Just flashes and shadows at the margins, far away and down branching tunnels, but closer than anyone cares to discover. His voice trembling and his breath weak as they hurry on, Adar says, "I hate those things. Why won't they leave us alone? We should kill them." Juman says,
"They are creatures of the Force, too."
"So?"
"So we do not attack."
"But we know they'll attack us."
"It is their way."
"Maybe their way is the dark side."
"Maybe Bryn has it right,"
Juman says.
"Maybe there is no dark side."
"It can't be that simple. I believe in evil. So does Bryn. Besides..."
Adar lifts his shirt and shows what he brought. A small blaster pistol.
"I have this. We can use it."
"You shouldn't have brought that. A lethal weapon? Here? On this sacred place? You know, Ra."
Ugorda shushes them both, and they continue on. On the eighth day, Ugorda is dead. Or so they believe. The kayadak come out of nowhere. Three of them. Their saw blade limbs cutting her down as the massive bugs pounce upon her. Pincers holding her fast. Juman has his telescoping staff out quick as anything, and he bares his teeth as it spins in his hand like a whirring rotor. He and Mabo leap into the fray. The droid lifts one of the kayadak high, flinging it into the trees. Branches snap, and crystal rains to the ground like a hail of singing, tinkling glass. Juman's staff connects with one of the bug's many eye heads, closing it permanently as it erupts in a gush of fluid. The thing shrieks and skitters away. The last one is Adar's. He rushes up to it, fear governing his limbs. He closes his eyes and draws the blaster pistol, firing it wantonly in the air. Not to kill, just to scare it off. He knows that when he opens his eyes, the monster will be upon him, cutting open his middle. But he hears its many limbs go tack, tack, tack in the other direction. Adar opens his eyes, and it's gone. Together they stare at Ugorda's dead body. Until she sits up suddenly, slick with her own blood. Adar wonders if she came back from the dead somehow, or if she was just not injured as badly as he thought. Ugorda wheezes.
"Let us keep moving. Those three will just be the first. They claim this forest as territory. When we are free of the trees, we are free of the kayadak."
They do as Ugorda says, helping her along. On the ninth day, they are out of the forest. Here the rocky ground gives way to crystal beneath, slippery and smooth, a thousand facets on which to lose one's footing. That night, they sit around the fire again. Mabo tends to Ugorda's wounds with a surprising tenderness, delicate despite the droid's massive, box-lifting limbs. Around the fire, Adar says to Juman,
"I want to ask you something."
"Ask?"
Juman purrs.
"When did you become a believer?"
Juman shrugs like it's no big thing.
"I had an experience. A vision called to me 3 years ago. It showed me a path through a wilderness not far from my home. I followed it, and there I found Bryn, injured after having fallen into a crevasse. I helped him, and he told me it was destiny that we met, that what guided me was the Force."
"You're lying. The Force is only for the Jedi."
"No,"
Juman says, not angry so much as he is incredulous.
They wield it, but the Force is in all living things. It is what gives us our intuition, our drive. It's what connects us to one another. We are all one with the Force.
The Force, the Force, the Force, everything the Force.
Adar is frustrated and afraid. He has no faith in this or in Aziska. Just because his mother helped found the church doesn't mean he has to be a believer too, does it? This is a fool's mission, a death parade. One of the so-called pilgrims is already dead. Another is almost perished. He whispers, "How many more of us have to die to carry this burden? We didn't steal these things. The Empire did. They should be the ones performing penance."
"We all carry the burden. We all pay the penance. Because..."
"Yes, yes, I know. Because we are all children of the Force."
"You should watch more of Aziska's hollow form."
"I don't want to."
But after the others are asleep, that's exactly what Adar does. He watches a vid of Bryn reading from the Journal of the Wills.
"The truth in our soul is that nothing is true. The question of life is, what then do we do? The burden is ours, to penance we hew. The Force binds us all, from a certain point of view."
Adar fails to understand what it means, but he admits he enjoys listening to Bryn. He falls asleep wondering who the man really is. No one seems to know much about him. He and many of the patrons and matrons of the church are mysterious. On the 10th day, they walk underneath an outcropping of crystal-encrusted rock, and a jagged stalactite of midnight glass breaks off. It spears Ugorda through the top of her head, and with that, she is truly gone. Then they are three. On the 12th day, they are hungry. They have food, of course, but all that's left are protein packets and neutro pills, and though such grim victuals keep them going, it's hardly satisfying. As night falls on that day, Mabo missteps across weak ground, and the crystalline mantle cracks hard beneath him. There is a moment when everyone realizes what is happening. The droid clings to the shelf, his telescoping eyes glowing white with panic. Adar leaps for the crate and catches the handle. Mabo lets go, because surely the droid understands that Adar cannot hold both the machine and the crate. And also, as Juman will soon point out,
Mabo had faith. He was a believer, a pilgrim like us, and a friend.
But Adar must ask himself, is he really a pilgrim? Or did the droid have more faith than he?
Adar saves the crate, even as the droid falls through the open gap.
"Bryn would be proud,"
Juman says, grinning a feral vulpine grin.
"You made a leap of faith, and the Force rewarded you. The Force rewarded us all."
He smirks.
"I have something to confess."
"So, confess."
"The vision I had, I still believe in it, but..."
His voice trails off.
"But what?"
"I was drunk at the time."
"Let's just get this done,"
Adar says, rolling his eyes.
"We're almost there."
He and his friend both carry the crate. It's heavy, so they share the load. And on the 13th day, the Kayadak return. They come fast, limbs clicking and clacking as they swarm from above and from below, pouring out like liquid shadow. They shriek and stab, and Juman tells Adar to go, go, keep going. Juman takes out his staff, spins it, and begins whipping it about. It connects with one Kayadak, then another, and the bug fiends are flung against the wall, screeching in pain. But there are too many. They swarm Juman,
Adar hugs the heavy crate to his chest and runs. His calves burn. His knees feel like they're going to pop. Everything hurts, but he continues on. A locator at his wrist beeps. This is it. This is where the crystals belong.
Smooth bore holes litter the walls. Here, the crystal isn't faceted, but rather sculpted, like wind-shaped glass. It's just like in Bryn's drawings.
He rushes forward, nearly tripping on a berm of aragonite poking up through the quartzine mantle.
But he manages to stay on his feet as he ducks into the darkness of this new passageway. Deeper, deeper he runs, grunting in pain, holding back tears,
ducking spears of crystal, slipping on smooth ground.
I've lost them. I've lost the Kayadak. And I've lost Juman, too.
Soon the cave begins to glow. In the dark crystal walls are other, smaller gems, each glowing bright. Different colors, like eyes watching. Red, green, blue. A feeling overtakes him. A strange, giddy madness. It rises within him, effervescent like bubbles. And he wonders, is this what being drunk feels like?
Then the tack, tack, tack of Kayadak limbs.
They're coming!
Panic rushes through him. He turns and sees that the way he came in is the only way. There are no other points of entry.
Out there, the shadows move and shift, sweeping in with alarming swiftness.
And he pulls his blaster and grits his teeth and begins firing wildly into the space. Plasma bolts cook the darkness. Kayadak scream!
And crystals shatter.
The walls and ceiling begin to fracture. The air is filled suddenly with the roar of the crumbling roof, and Adar falls, crab walking backward as the cave passageway is swiftly closed off by a wall of ruined, broken crystal.
He can barely catch his breath. The Kayadak are gone. The wall is impenetrable.
Many of the creatures may be buried beneath it. Adar doesn't know. When he has his bearings, he sees now that there is nowhere deeper to go. This is the end of this cave.
He tries fruitlessly to dig himself out, but it is no use. The crystals cut his hands. The wall will not be moved.
Instead, he slumps back against the wall and draws the crate toward him.
He pops a series of latches.
The lid opens. Inside waits a series of crystals, like the ones in the walls and ceiling above. Hundreds of them. Adar stifles a cry, then withdraws another of the projector discs.
He places it in his lap and ignites it. Again, the hollow form of Bryn Iziska appears. The vid of Bryn says,
just as the Jedi are a lens that focuses the Force, so is the Kyber crystal a lens that focuses the light inside the Jedi.
And the light inside the Jedi's weapon, the lightsaber.
But those crystals can be used for greater, more evil powers. The Sith focus the Force, too. But they use it not for light, but only for destruction. These crystals were taken from Christophsis to power two of the most insidious weapons built. The legacy of Galen Erso. The legacy of Orson Krennic. Of Tarkin and the Sith, of Palpatine and Vader. The Death Stars are gone. Light has persevered through the necessity of dark. These crystals must go home. That is your task.
With that, Adar begins taking the crystals out one by one, setting them down into the cave from which they had been taken years before. He sets the disc to project the holoform once again.
He
he tries not to think about how this is the place where he's going to die, or, in Bryn's words, where he will soon join with the living force. All hail the light, the dark, and the gray.